Sometimes I land under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Petron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself to see if these things be true. All right, good afternoon, folks. Happy Tuesday. Welcome back. And, of course, it's time for the Torah Teachers Roundtable. In this case, the Tanakh edition, where we talk about those other parts of Scripture that aren't part of the weekly Torah portion or sometimes the Haftorah portion. And what we've been doing for quite a while now is going through some of the prophets. And in particular, the ones that everyone knows the names, at least those that aren't completely scripturally ignorant. We finished the book of Yirmiyahu or Jeremiah last week, and we started into a new book, and one of the other so-called major prophets, certainly a very interesting fellow, Ezekiel. And last week we kind of touched on some of the life and times, a little bit of the background, and just began to look into chapter 1, and a pretty, I guess you'd say, interesting, maybe even confusing vision that he lays out here in the first chapter. So with that, let me promise what I would do is reread at least the, I believe it was starting in around verse 7, and I'll reread about four verses or so. Then we'll go to Ken, let him comment on that. But I will start at verse 6 because he's describing these four living creatures, each one of which, it says, had four faces. Each one had four wings. And verse 7 says, their legs were straight. And the soles of their feet, like the soles of calves' feet. We did talk about this some last week, and I know Ken will pick it up there. They sparkle like the color of burnished bronze. The hands of a man under their wings on their four sides, and each of the four had faces and wings. Their wings touched one another. They didn't turn when they went, but each one went straight forward. And let's pause at that point. That's a good stopping point. So good afternoon, Ken. Welcome. How you doing?
Oh, I'm rather exhausted. We've been moving from our residence where we lived for about 17 years. We've gathered a lot of stuff through the years in this one house, you know. And we're downsizing to our cabin, which is about 675 square feet. So it's a major downgrade. But we've been at this for about 2.5 months now, and we have to be out of here in the next week and a half. So we're getting down to the crunch here, you know. but anyway, even though I'm exhausted, I'm always excited to partake in this here endeavor, and I want to welcome everybody who's listening. And I did want to comment on verse 7 again. I know I started this the last week, but I don't believe I finished, and I'm not sure where I left off. So let me go ahead and recount what I had said in regards to verse 7. Now, again, this is regarding the feet and the sole of the feet. You'll notice that they are mentioned distinctively. So I think it is important that Ezekiel's word shows differentiation between what we are perceiving as the whole foot and the sole of the foot. In spiritual understanding, one's walk has to do with one's righteousness, in which walking straight is figurative of walking in his ways. And the word straight in this verse is the Hebrew word Yeshar, which is Strong's number H3477. Now, interestingly enough, this word is not introduced in Scripture first until Shemot or Exodus 15, verse 26, which provides us with these words. And said, if thou wilt diligently hearken to the voice of Yahuwah thy Elohim, and wilt do that which is right, that word right is the Hebrew word yeshar, in his sight, and wilt give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of these diseases upon thee, which I have brought upon the Mitzrites or Egyptians, for I am Yahuwah that healeth thee. Now, if one considers Job as the oldest text in Scripture, then this would be the first instance of this word yashar, but rendered as the word upright, where it's written, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was perfect and upright, that's the word yashar, and one that feared Elohim and eschewed evil. Now, in either case, in either of these two instances, we can see the spiritual connection with this word, vice possibly understanding of a physical walking straight, neither to the left nor the right. But even with this idea of not turning to the left or the right, I'd like to recall this good verse of his, which is Devarim, or Deuteronomy 5, verse 32, where it's written, ye shall observe to do therefore as Yahuwah your Elohim hath commanded you. Ye shall not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. And thus I believe these entities to be doing exactly as Yah prescribed, being good and faithful servants, as a good man or good men should, in walking straight. Okay, it's the word, again, yashar. Now, regarding the sole of the foot, likened to the palm of the hand, this is the part of the foot that makes contact with the earth or whatever else is being walked upon. And these are likened to a calf's foot here. A calf, which is egel in the Hebrew, Strong's number H5695, is known to be a young cow, which grows up to become a bull. Thus, it is a creature that is still in a learning phase. It's also used specifically in what Yisrael built to worship when Moshe first led them into the wilderness, in which Yah was greatly displeased. And in my reasoning, we see the color of the sole of this foot being brass or bronze, which brings to mind, my mind, to the outer parts of the tabernacle that pertain to those in sin, but seeking to draw near unto Yah. Such parts that were made of brass or bronze were the laver, various vessels, parts of the columns, and parts of the altar. The differences between the metals of gold, silver, and brass or bronze were spiritually significant. Thus, we should consider this fact in the sole of the foot or feet of these four entities and in what they may make contact with when placing the sole of their feet upon something. And we see, of course, that at times they're on the earth or they're where they're lifted up from the earth. In either case, there is this concept of the sole of the foot being brass or bronze. So that's what I wanted to detail on verse 7. Now, verse 8, this is a little different here with the hands. We note that there are plural hands of a man for each face on each entity. Thus, there are 8 total hands, 2 per side. I suppose we should have expected hands since these entities resemble a man, right? And thus they have a face, they have feet, and they have hands. But I do find it interesting that the hands are beneath the wings. So recall that 2 of the wings are used to cover the body, and thus would be covering the hands as well. Even the hands need protection, which makes sense considering the hands represent the works of a man, and thus has always been less than perfect, as we all know. And lastly, verse 9, which I think that's where Mark read through. I believe the word joined not only means that they are attached together in some way, in terms of the wings, but also that they are working together in unison. And of course, if they fluttered in complete unison, then the entity would fly perfectly straight, which I'm sure is representative of moving in the ways of Yah as he prescribes. And note the word forward, which is the Hebrew word panim, Strong's number H6440, which is usually translated as before or in front of, or even the word face. I can imagine these entities totally focused on him and his spirit, and thus their face would always be forward and not veering to the left or to the right. Now also note the word for everyone. This is actually the Hebrew word ish, Strong's number H376, which is most often, nearly 1,000 times of over 1,700 occurrences in the Tanakh, is translated as the word man. So this word is most likely providing us this hint that we need as to what metaphorically is being referenced with regards to these four entities. Okay? Hint, hint. So that's what I have up through verse 9.
Okay. Interesting. MP, you want to comment, add anything, or you want to move on?
Well, I'm going to comment on the same thing, same kind of stuff anyway. Mine's going to be a little bit different perspective. I'm going to start with this little thing I got from where did I get this? The line Kav within the residue. This has to do with some things that have to do with Kabbalah. You know, there's kosher Kabbalah and there's non-kosher Kabbalah. You got to watch out for what you're looking at there. But anyway, it says the line Kav within the residue. Not only does the Ein Sof, that is Yah himself, okay, continue to surround the space of the Tzimtzum on every side, but according to Kabbalistic knowledge, a single line, the Hebrew Kav, that what marks off a possession, was drawn from Ein Sof's infinite light, like a pipe down into a residue. This line is the direct government of the Creator inside the created world. According to Kabbalah, through the line of the Kav, and by the way, Azamra is people that I quote quite a bit they study Kabbalah and they study kosher Kabbalah, so that's where I'm coming from here. According to Kabbalah, through the line of the Kav, the Creator acts from his own level of complete perfection, unity, and limitlessness in guiding everything that happens in the creation. The line, however, remains clothed in the residue, so the created beings only see the actions of the residue. The actions of the Creator are concealed within it. In other words, within the line. That's what I'm saying here. Now, the residue itself includes all of creation, both the good and the bad. It is built on the laws of choice, reward, and punishment. However, the residue is ruled by the line, which operates on the level of unity and complete goodness. Because of this, the laws of reward and punishment continue only for a set time. So it is said that the residue is like a wheel that turns through just so many degrees until it completes the entire cycle, as the Ein Sof brings evil back to good through the revelation of his perfect unity.
Okay, well, MP, I got to stop you just a second.
Go ahead.
Okay, because there's so much there that honestly I'm not sure if it's I don't want to be disrespectful, but what the heck is residue and what are we really talking about there?
Okay, I'm not real sure myself. The residue is some residual stuff from before the creation, I'm thinking. I don't know. I started to see this stuff and it kind of fits the way that the scripture here talks. Okay, this is one of the deepest chapters of scripture. This one that we're looking at right now, Ezekiel chapter 1. And I'm trying to draw from different areas here. Anyway, that quoted text above is based on openings 24 through 30 on pages 75 through 110 of the book 138 Openings of Wisdom. I have that book here, by the way, by Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. And from a Zomer Institute. It's very deep. It's too deep for me. I started reading it, and I could not get past opening 28 of 138 openings. It was just too wonderful for me to comprehend. Literally mind-blowing. Okay, but this stuff all had to do with what we saw last week in verses 1 through 6. Now in verses 1 through 7, and I'm going to start with a. I'm sorry again.
I didn't say anything that time.
Oh, I thought you were. Thought you were trying. Okay, Azamra has this on the straight feet. Now it talks about the straight feet here. They did not have joints, since unlike material animals, they had no need to bend their legs to sit or lie down. That's according to Rashi. From this verse, we learn that when praying the Amidah prayer, we should position our feet straight together like angels, according to Berachot 10b. Okay, that's maybe Azamra, but when it comes to feet, were straight feet. I think that's talking about the bottoms of the feet, like those of the lunar lander of Apollo 11, which were round, flat pads, kind of like a cow or horse-kind hooves. The idea being to distribute the weight over a larger area than deer and such do. The burnished brass is what gave me the idea of Apollo 11, since the photos of the lander from near the landing site often had solar sparks, as it were, of light reflecting off the legs and feet of the lander. Now, verse 8 says that these chayot, the chayot are living creatures, okay, is what it's what they're called in the King James. These chayot had human hands under their wings on all four sides. Perhaps they were being lifted by these hands, plural, under which each of these wings, or the wings, were ornamental. But there were at least two hands under each wing. So there had to be that many men lifting each of these chayot, these living creatures. Now the Hebrew word that's translated under there, the KJV, is metacham, okay? Mitcham, from under or the bottom of their wings. In other words, someone who is not visible to the observer, but there is a handprint evidence of him lifting them in action. This can be none other than Yah, probably Mashiach, a handprint scene, actually performing the action and letting another get the glory from the casual observer. I don't know if Yehezkel knew of Mashiach Yeshua yet, but if he didn't, he certainly had evidence enough to make him think that his way through this problem. Now, in verse 9, it says that the wings were joined one to another. I assume that they were sort of welded, the one to the other at about a 90-degree angle, so that four of them would have eyes on everything round about and be able to alert the others to any danger that might be coming from each cardinal direction. Remember that these living creatures have eyes round about, okay? And they show themselves to be kind of in a square configuration, so you get eyes looking one direction and exactly the opposite, and then to either side. So it's really kind of interesting what this living creature is. Okay, so I would assume that the chayot had at least 120-degree angle of vision, like we humans have. Okay, when I look straight ahead, I can see roughly 60 degrees either way in my peripheral vision. Okay, I'm able, as I just said. For instance, right this minute, I'm looking straight ahead, and I perceive a book on the shelf above my desk, and I'm aware of the books on the shelf above it. Without moving my head, I can shift my eyes to easily read the titles of the books. One of them happens to be 138 Openings to Wisdom by Ramchal. So anyway, I'm looking straight ahead and I can see all of that. Without moving my head, I can shift my eyes and I can see as far as 40 to 45 degrees to right or left of my center. I therefore have a periphery of about 160 to 170 degrees of motion and can focus on everything in a 90-degree radius in front of me just by shifting my eyes. These chayot, these living creatures, probably had at least that much visual periphery as well, and perhaps more. And I assume that they were in direct comms with Mashiach the whole time, and that he perceived exactly what they did, and that simultaneously. So there was no delay of quick action. We went right through 9, is that correct?
That's affirmative.
Okay, then that's where I'm done. That's verse 9.
Okay, how about you, Ken? You ready to go on?
Okay.
Yes, if we could go ahead and read a few verses again.
All right. Let's go to about the wheels within the wheels, about 7 verses. As for the likeness of their faces, each had the face of a man. Each of the four had the face of a lion on the right side. Each of the four had the face of an ox on the left side. And each of the four had the face of an eagle. So obviously the backside, if that's the one that's left. Thus were their faces, their wings stretched forward. Two of each touched one another, and two covered their bodies. And on each one went straight forward. They went wherever the Spirit wanted them to go, and they did not turn when they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance like burning coals of fire, like the appearance of torches going back and forth among the living creatures. The fire was bright, and out of the fire went lightning. And the living creatures ran back and forth in appearance like a flash of lightning. Now, as I looked at the living creatures, behold, a wheel on the earth beside each living creature with its four faces. So here is the first reference to the wheel on the earth beside each living creature with its four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their workings was like the color of beryl, and all four had the same likeness. Their appearance of their working was, as it were, a wheel within the middle of a wheel. And let me read one more, I guess, because when they moved, it says, they went toward any one of the four directions. They did not turn aside when they went. So let's pause there. And MP, we'll go to you this time first.
Okay. Beginning in verse 10, verse 10 tells us about their faces. In other words, they each had four faces. The first face was a man's face. The second face to the right was that of a lion. The third face towards the left was that of an ox, and the fourth face towards the rear was that of an eagle. And I think that Mashiach, who had control of all of them, would assess the situation and send the one as commander who was most certain to make any encounter short and victorious. In verse 11, each chaya, each living creature, had four wings in two pairs. The wings were not deployed for flight, as two were joined to the wings of the chaya on their left and right, while two covered their bodies, like armor, kind of. Stone's Chumash quotes Rashi that the two wings covered their faces to not gaze on Elohim's glory. I can see at least this many possibilities. Maybe my colleagues have another opinion or option about that, but I'll comment through verse 14. Zamra says that on verses 12 through 14, that this is what they say. Verse 12 and following portray the chayot, that's living creatures, in movement and their relationship with the ofanim beneath them. The chayot move because of the ruach, the will of Elohim, that is clothed within them. That's according to verse 12. Now the chayot can move in any direction without turning because they have faces in all of the directions. They are described as running and returning in verse 14. The metaphor is one of the flame of a furnace or a bolt of lightning.
Okay, so right now the metaphor is we've got to go right, so we'll pick it up there.
And I pray, don't take me soon, because I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday the Lord will turn around, because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we know what I'm fighting for.
Come a come a dum doo be doo dum down. Keeping Torah's a joy to do. They say that I'm by the law. The 16 and many more. Don't they know what's really true? It's you and die for me and you. I keep the peace. Java still 6,000 years old. It's not new.
All right. Did we get MP interrupted? Is that where we were? You ready to, you want to continue, MP?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Yes, sir. Going to continue on here. Okay. The, we were talking about the Chayot and, the Ofanim and all of that. Let's see. I'm going to start this all over again. Verses 12 and following portray the Chayot in movement and their relationship with the Ofanim beneath them. The Chayot move because of the Ruach, the will of God, that is clothed within them, in verse 12. The Chayot can move in any direction without turning because they have faces on all, in all directions. They are described as running and returning, in verse 14. The metaphor is one of the flame of a fire, or the bolt of lightning which shoots out and virtually simultaneously flashes back from where it came. Similarly, when the Chayot move their heads out from under the firmament that is stretched above them, they become filled with fear because of the Shekhinah, which is above the firmament, and they hurriedly bring their heads back under. That according to Rashi. Now the Chayot are, that's the living creatures, are spiritual forces yearning for God and seeking to transcend their boundaries. But they can do so only for a moment before fear and trepidation force them to retreat. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov taught that the mode of running and returning characterizes all spiritual life and endeavor. We must constantly strive to go beyond our boundaries, yet we are constrained to remain within them, and our task is to actualize the vision we attain at moments of transcendence within the limitations that God has set for our lives. That's according to Likutei Mohoran 1, 6, and 22. Now, it seems that the Chayot can move only in the cardinal direction, straight forward, straight back, okay, for themselves. Of course, with Yazruach moving the Chayot, they are probably moving at translight or warp speed, you know what I mean? And it's possible that under the hand of Yah Yeshua, they truly can do transwarp speeds and perhaps achieve thought speed, you know, just thinking of a place in time, past or future, and being there. You know, so Yah does it all the time because he is the eternal when and where. Okay, he's omniscience, he's omnipresence. Those are factors in his existence. He is there and here, right now. And he has been, is, and will be forever. And he doesn't get bored because he's got all that stuff to look at, I guess. Anyway. So in verse 13, the appearance of the Chayot is like red-hot coals or steel under intense heat or flame, as if it was producing a flame of its own, while the steel being consumed in its own heat, leaving not even an ash, not melting, but utterly consumed. These Chayot looked like white-hot coals in a fire, and it spewed forth lightning. You American constitutional patriots are going to love this, if it's the first time you hear it. The word translated lightning is barak, okay? To flash light, flashing brilliant precious stone, shining weapon, and prickly thorn. Now, there is no Hebrew for Obama, so I'm just going to have to stick with the Hebrew barak. But the root barak means to raise up, elevate to a higher place, altar, or high mountain, all of which I think he would apply to himself. Now, well, in verse 14...
And it can also mean blessing. That's the way most people are going to remember the word, the root word there, Mark.
Say that again?
I was going to say, the way most people are going to remember the word Barak or Barku, the various references, are going to be blessing. Baruch atah Adonai, right?
Yes. Well, that's it. I get it. But Barack Obama was not a blessing.
No, I understand. And it's one of the rare cases where somebody actually absconds with the wrong name.
Exactly. That's the way I see it, too. Now, in verse 14, the chayot, they ratza, they ran. The root means to run or delight in or accept, which two definitions tell me that the chayot were happy to see the light of Yah Yeshua return as a flash of lightning. Are you beginning to think that this may be the end of days prophecy? It may be an end of days prophecy. I really think that it could be. In fact, I think it's most definitely an end of days prophecy, and I'm seeing a lot of parallels going on today that we see in these prophecies. Okay, and that's what I got through verse 14.
Okay. Ken, how about you? You want to pick it up where you'd like? And
sure. I know you had just read through verse 12, correct?
Actually, I read further than that. Sorry. I read all the way through verse 17.
Oh, you did. Okay. Okay, so let me pick it up at verse 10. In verse 10, it's interesting to see these four faces being of four different creatures. One of a man, but the other three were beasts, a lion, an ox, and an eagle, to be exact. This imagery is repeated in Revelation 4, verse 7. Only these are four individual beasts with a single head, but yet they are the same four beasts spoken of here in Ezekiel.
That's one of
there are quite a few differences as well, but they surely must be thematically connected. These beasts in Revelation were witnesses around the throne, giving glory and honor to the one sitting on the throne. So let's keep this in mind as we find out more about the four entities here in the scroll of Ezekiel. I also note that the man and the ox seem to be opposite each other, which are clean. The lion and the eagle, opposite each other, are unclean. Thus also the unclean happen to be to the left and to the right. And here we've heard about this living creature only moving straight, not veering to the left or to the right. So really, in other words, the direction that the living creature is moving would only be where the face of the man is looking or the face of the ox is looking. Okay? Back and forth. Not to the left, not to the right. Now, verses 11 to 12, we see the detail more so of the two wings in use for covering and the other two stretched upward, causing them to always move straight forward, following the spirit wherever it went. It's mentioned that they turned not. I do believe this is, again, a spiritual understanding, that they went where the Spirit desired them to go, and they did not falter from this lead. In other words, not veering to the left or to the right. And we know scripturally when falling to the left or to the right, normally you're falling away from Yah's will. Even a matter of fact, a name like that was riding on the donkey.
Balaam
is it I'm thinking of?
You're talking about the parsha is called Balak, and it was Balaam in the English, that it was Balaam's ass, basically,
more
than he did, yeah.
Right, and Balaam is actually the opposite there, where he was walking in the wrong direction, and of course, eventually the donkey fell over, caused
The donkey saved his life.
Off.
The ass, and that's the female donkey. She saved his life, and the messenger, when he finally gets caught between literally a place that's too narrow, is when the donkey just lays down under good old Bilaam, and then Yah opens the mouth of the donkey, who proceeds to give Bilaam a nice Socratic questioning. Hey, have I ever done anything like this before? Hey, does it maybe occur to you there's a reason? And then Yah opens the angel's eyes, and he says, "Yeah, I'm the reason, and I would have probably just whacked you if it hadn't been for her and left her alone and left her alive." So, there's a real strong message there, is the story. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lesson of that thing is, don't get so angry that you can't think, because that's what happened with Balak. I mean, here's this donkey talking to him, right? And he doesn't remember, doesn't think that, wait a minute. This is a donkey. It can't talk to me. I mean, we get so stupid, we humans, sometimes.
That's right. But, of course, here the donkey was being led in the wrong direction. The scroll of Ezekiel, this movement of going straight is actually in the direction of the desire of the spirit. So I believe this is a good thing, unlike what we've read elsewhere. Now verse 13 is really good. I looked long and hard throughout Scripture to find a single verse that described what a lamp looks like. Now I know everybody's going to think, well, what do you mean? What does a lamp look like? Well, I would just like to read how Yah sees what a lamp really is, or what it looks like. And I really could not find such existence. And thus I find it quite odd that Ezekiel is using this object, the lamp, as the object of appearance. I can only mentally gather that lamps were so common in one's life, especially in the nighttime, that there was no mistaking its appearance. And it's the appearance that we must focus on with regards to the lamp, and not its likeness. Likeness can go beyond physical appearances and can be compared to the word image. Such man was created in the image and likeness of Yah. And since Yah is a spiritual being, there should be less emphasis given to physical aspects. Thus, in considering both coals on fire that we're seeing in this verse and a lamp burning from either a liquid or wax with a wick, I would envision such an appearance to include shades of light brighter in the core area, and the movement of light differentiation at all times, because it's flickering, it's moving. I mean, we see that when we see fire, there's always movement. And apparently this movement was in an up and down manner, which is surely unique in itself. But I think it is in conjunction with the direction that the entity is moving. It is only moving forward and back. Now, apparently, I think such brightness of this fire might be a good indicator to the viewer that this is a holy or even spiritual entity. When it says it was very bright, especially considering the addition of lightning spewing forth as well. Such renderings of, especially with lightning and extremely brightness coming from a creature or an entity, often brings me to remembrance of either Yah himself or descriptions of the coming of our Messiah. So, I find this very interesting, the way that these details are given to us. And then, now again, one thing we have to keep in mind regarding this entire chapter is that this is a vision, and every vision in Scripture is just that. It is metaphoric in nature. Okay. It's never physically likened to what it's portraying. Okay, it's always something else, but likened. You know, I'm not sure how else to really word that. Like for example, when we remember Peter or Kepha, when he had a vision of the unclean animals coming down on a sheet. Okay, and there were four corners of the sheet. You know, now that was a indicator of all of mankind, those animals on a sheet. It was actually figurative of all of mankind throughout the whole world. And that's really what that meant. So, you know, it's not like there were unclean animals being actually spoken of or a bed sheet, for example, you know. That's not what it really was. It was metaphoric of something else.
And by the way,
so we have to keep this in mind.
A quick aside.
Go ahead and see.
By the way, the reason we know this, and this is where the Christian church pretty well misses the mark, is because Kepha, Peter, comes right out about five verses later and tells you what the meaning of his dream was. So there's no doubt about it.
Exactly.
He doesn't leave any questions.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, actually, you can't. I think the actual detail came out way back in like verse 26 of that chapter 10 of Acts, where he shared that with the whole group, saying, "Yah showed me this," you know.
Yeah, here's the real meaning. Yeah,
exactly. And that was speaking of man.
Yeah, the whole point of that vision was there were clean animals and there were unclean animals. They were in one sheet. They were all bunched together. They came out, and Yah says, "Kill and eat, Peter." And he says, "I've never touched anything that was contaminated or unclean." Okay? And he said, "Don't you call what I created clean unclean." And it was that point that got Peter. And he said, "Oh, yeah, they're clean animals. They didn't become unclean just because they touched an unclean animal." That was the tradition that he had to get disabused of. And that's the beauty of that particular thing. And Peter, and as soon as the vision is over, he hears a knock on the door, and there's three Gentiles waiting at the door for him. And he says, "Let them come in. Let's feed them."
Right.
I mean, he learned that lesson like right now.
And you know, another example that most people would probably remember would be Pharaoh's vision, where there were 10 skinny cows that I believe they
right.
ate the 10 fat cows, right?
Yep.
And that's not what really happened. It didn't even have to do with cows. So that's where we have to be careful with all of this. You know, we
yep.
shouldn't be focused on trying to imagine this actually being a creature and this is exactly what it looks like. Okay, we have to be figurative or metaphoric in our understanding.
We have to at least understand the metaphor that's being shown to us. That's the
right.
thing. Yeah.
Now,
anyway,
verse 14, this is the fact that it ran and returned as the appearance of a flash of lightning. I mean, wow, this is amazing because this detail of the literal speed and movement of these living creatures would probably be considered the fastest of any described action in all of scripture and history. I mean, consider the speed to the naked eye of a lightning strike. You know, I don't believe there is any such comparison to consider. I mean, not a one. And this is yet another indicator that such a creature here is literally touched by Yah in ways that we as humans can't quite imagine. I mean, to me, it even brings me to this TV show I saw a few years back called The Flash, you know, and this guy could literally run at the speed of lightning. It was crazy. But
yeah.
I think that's to give us another insight, okay? Not that there is literally a creature that is running that fast back and forth, but there is insight to going forward and coming back, you know, and
right.
that's just more for us to consider. So anyway, that's what I had through verse 14.
Okay, are we ready to read on?
Right.
Sure.
We got the wheel within a wheel that we're talking about at this point. And it says when they moved, they went in any of those four directions. They didn't turn aside when they went. As for their rims, meaning the rims of the wheels, they were so high, they were awesome. And their rims were full of eyes all around the four of them. When the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them. And when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. So I'm picturing a landing gear, right? The living creatures go up, so do the wheels. Wherever the spirit wanted to go, the Ruach, I'm pretty sure I don't have it sitting here in front of me, but I believe that's the word there. The Ruach wanted to go, they went. There the spirit went. And the wheels were lifted together with them, for the spirit, and it's probably the same word, of the living creatures was in the wheels. The spirit, living creatures, in the wheels, was is added there, but that's from the Hebrew grammar. And let me read one more voice and we'll pause. I'll go to Ken. When those went, these went. And when those stood, these stood. And when those were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up together with them. For the Ruach, the spirit of the living creatures, was in the wheels, is the point. Okay, go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, now I'm going to start back here in verse 15. Looking at many different translations of verse 15, all render the single wheel as belonging to a single living creature. And verse 16 indicates there were four total wheels. But in my mind, there is a difference with each wheel, since one wheel was within another wheel. To me, this must mean that each wheel was of a different size. This also backs up the fact that verse 15 indicates that just one wheel was upon the earth, not all four. This would surely be true with the concept of the largest wheel housing all others. And thus, just the bigger wheel was literally touching the earth. But there is a concept that this likeness generates in my mind, and that is of gears. With gears, all work together in unison, one affecting the other, yet working together towards a common goal. In today's world, this sounds very much like a machine, okay? but at the same time, we can certainly consider the fact that Yah desires all of us to be working together towards one goal, of course, which is Him. He is our goal, okay? And it makes pure sense to me that each and every creature that we're seeing here is has that in their spirit. This is the spirit that is leading them, okay? So it's no wonder that each wheel works in unison with the other wheel, with the one wheel touching the other wheel, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they're all working together. They're all most likely turning at different speeds because, again, you have one that's bigger, one that's smaller. It also reminds me of one of our Brit HaShaar, our New Testament passages where our Messiah speaks about talents. You know, certain people can handle a larger amount of talents, and others can only handle a smaller amount. And Yah gives it to each one according to what they can handle. You know, never too much, just like His word, never too much. It's always just the right amount. And this could be the same with the wheel, you know. Each wheel could be sized according to the individual, according to that entity. You know, maybe one turns a little slower than the other. Maybe another one turns faster. So what does Yah do? He has them work together still. Even though they're operating at different speeds, they can still work together, which makes this whole thing so cool. You know, it makes the machine, so to speak, likened to all of us together, working together. You know, as one. And that really kind of fascinates me with these gears and such.
All right. Wheels. Well, we're at the top of the hour break. We'll pick it up with the wheels.
And I break. Don't take me soon, because I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know something. Turn around because all my life I've been waiting for.
to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Petron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true. All right, we are back, and we are talking today about the first chapter of the book of Ezekiel, and working our way through the somewhat intricate and obviously. Now, there's been lots of speculation over the years. Description of the four living creatures and the things that are going on here. And as we went to break, the idea was wheels within wheels. And I want to interject something, and I'll go back to where Ken was when we got to the break. But he had a number of suggestions. I'm going to add one in because ultimately you're going to hear this, and whether we agree or not, I'm going to at least point it out. Ken made a reference to whether or not there's a mechanical thing going on here. Certainly wheels are, I don't think of any example of a living creature in nature that has wheels. But certainly a lot of the things that men do have wheels. Yep. Obviously, things that men do and then attach to animals would have been common even in this day. Wheels on an ox cart, that kind of thing, they would have known. But certainly the speculation, and I'll, like I said, I don't necessarily agree with this, but I think it's fair to pitch it out there. Understand that the description here has oftentimes been looked at by people say, oh, these are UFOs. You know, the wheels go up, these things go up, and that's what Ezekiel is having a vision of, is UFOs, and maybe this will be, I guarantee you we're going to hear this trotted out when the Greys and all these other aliens come back to Earth and say, oh, see, this is what your book was telling about. We are the ones that created you, and there'll be a major attempt at deception. So that's part A. One other thing, this is just on a personal note, whenever I see wheels within wheels, I can't help but think about cycles within cycles, and I use that metaphor frequently. It literally is the way that the creator of the universe designed the universe. The differential equation solution, when I was in college studying engineering, it used to bug me that they would always say, assume a solution of this form, e to the minus st dt, and what is that? Well, that's a damped or an underdamped exponential, a sinusoid. All of these things, in other words, literally describe the mechanics of the universe, wheels within wheels, sine waves upon sine waves, oscillations. It's amazing to me how appropriate the description is anyway, whether it's talking about UFOs or not. So, Ken, back to you.
Sure. I think I finished up with 16. Let me move on to 17. I think in 17 it's important that this verse reiterates the fact that when living creatures went, they went or moved straight. Not only is this a second witness for importance sake to repeat verse 12, but also that once the idea of the four wheels moving together towards one goal, this goal is moving straight, as in his walk or in his ways. I believe that's what is really meant by straight here. It's not veering to the left or right, which is falling away from his ways. Verse 18. This does get interesting here. I find this translation of rings for the Hebrew word gab, which is Strong's number H1354, interesting, since it's the only time that the Hebrew word is translated as such. And looking at other translations, half of these translations, you see the word rings, and the other half, you see the word rims. The reason I find it so odd is that the very next Hebrew word here in this verse is the same word, but with the hey added at the end, or goba, which is Strong's number H1363. Thus, the first instance should be a root of the second. And yet we see the two words totally different in English translation. I wonder if gab, the Hebrew word gab, instead of being translated here as I'm sorry, has rings, I wonder if it couldn't be translated as the word height, which would fit between the two words height and so high. In any case, there appears to be a great amount of eyes encircling the living creatures, which appears to not only give it enormity, but much presence with viewing through so many eyes. It truly would be a spectacle. But again, we should strongly consider the fact throughout this chapter that this is a vision, and thus most, if not all, that we are describing should be metaphoric of something else, but with similarities. And yeah, I could go on this on my notes here, but this is actually what I mentioned in one of the previous verses. But in any case, with regards to all these eyes, I wonder if this idea of eyes to where it can see all around, I wonder if this might not have something to do with time. Meaning, let's say that these creatures are metaphoric or are to be picturing mankind as a whole, right? All throughout the world, meaning that's why there's four, you know? Just like in Kepha or Peter's vision, there was four corners of the sheet, and that was a picture of the whole world, you know? So maybe the four could have to do with, you know, four directional references like north, south, east, west. Matter of fact, I think I had these notes in a later verse. So sorry if I might reiterate it in a little bit here. But I wonder if this with the eyes concept, if that might not have to do with mankind through time, meaning he's been seen throughout different time periods, these four entities, these four creatures, you know, moving forward and back might have something with this as well, because in different times, could be moving forward more so. At different times, he could be moving back more so, or falling away, you know, so to speak. So, you know, that's just one idea to consider anyway. Let's see. Now I do have some notes on verses 19 to 21. Did you read through 21, MC?
I read through verse.
If 20, not, yes. I'll just.
Yeah, basically.
Basically, okay.
The wheels go up when they go up.
Let me just go ahead and put. Okay, let me quickly comment then on 19 to 21. Verses 19 through 21 explain how the living creatures and their spirit within the wheels move together. It's clear that the spirit was leading, and thus, whether moving upon the earth or lifted up from it, both the living creature and its wheels would move together. Even when still, both would be still. Okay, so you can see how the spirit or the wheel of the creature is always with the creature. To me, again, this very well could be metaphoric of man himself or mankind, because as long as he is alive, remember, the spirit is with and in him. Okay? But of course, when man dies, the spirit goes to a certain place. So they're not moving in sync anymore, are they? Anyway, something to consider, and that's through 21, so I'll go ahead and let MP catch up.
Well, I'm not going to quite catch up, but I'll give you 15 to 17.
Okay.
Zahm has this on 15 to 17. Just as when animals draw an earthly chariot, they cause its wheels to turn, so the celestial chayot cause the ofan, the wheel of the divine chariot, to move. The Ofan is an angel that stands on the earth, and his head reaches the Chayot. And his name is Sandalfon. That's Hagiga 13b. This Talmudic comment alludes to the way that the lower levels of God's governmental order are like a shoe or a sandal that garbs the lowest of the upper levels, that is the feet, and through which those high levels operate in order to bring about specific effects on earth. The Hebrew word translated as angel is malach, which essentially means a messenger or angel, or agent rather, through which another higher force operates. Metzudas David on verse 15 states that each chaya had only one ofan rather than a separate ofan for each of its four faces. Each ofan was like a wheel within a wheel, effectively turning it into a kind of ball that would roll in any directions without ever needing to turn, according to verse 17. Now, the ofanim had eyes all over them so that they could see in all directions since they never turned. That's according to Azamra, and they're like I said, they do the Kabbalah and all that stuff, and they work all that stuff in. So anyway, as we said before, each ofan, wheel or living creature, has four faces, panayim, and I think we'll be getting back to this one orphan, ofan rather before long. Orphan, one ofan before long. The fact that the pronoun near the end of the verse, his, is singular. While there is only one singular noun anywhere in the verse, that is wheel, which is upon the earth, means that the wheel is the antecedent to the pronoun his. Therefore, the wheel near the living creatures, plural, has four faces, as do the other living creatures. Now, I don't know Hebrew grammar anywhere near as well as I know English grammar, but I have a feeling that it isn't very different. Rav Greenbaum at Azamra is pretty convinced that the wheels within wheels belong to the Ofanim, or the living creatures. So do I, and for what that may be worth. Now, I looked up beryl online and I found this. A mineral of great hardness, and when transparent, of much beauty. It occurs in hexagonal prisms, commonly of a green or bluish-green color, but also yellow, pink, or white. It is a silicate of aluminum and beryllium. The aquamarine is a transparent sea green variety used as a gem. The emerald is another variety highly prized in jewelry and distinguished by its deep color. Now, did you notice that the beryl is mostly found in one of four colors? Green or slash blue green, okay, which can be the same. Yellow, pink, and white. Four faces. Four colors. Coincidence? Maybe. Another interesting thing is that the word panaim is a plural form of the unused root panay, which means to safeguard. So the eagle, the man, the lion, and the ox are each probably also one of the four colors. So there are four wheels, each a different color, but built similarly as a wheel within a wheel. Is that kind of like a tire on an automobile wheel hub? Could it be, though the motion may be in a different plane than an auto tire? It could be something like rocket engines as well. I think the Apollo rockets were of a four-engine variety. I think I remember that, but I'm not certain. Now, verse 17 says that they went on their four sides. The word side is from the Hebrew 7253, rava, to breed or increase. I don't think these faces were breeding, but they could have been increasing. There are lots of ways to increase, not just by procreating children. The Hebrew 1980 halach is used three times within this one verse and means to progress step by step toward a goal. These ofanim are not wandering, but are, to quote the Ghostbusters, on a mission from Gad. Their halakha has a point. They have a point in everything that they're doing. That's what I got through verse 17. I can go on, but we're not that close. All right, let's go through verse 20. Okay, so it's 18:20. Azamra opens with this. Verse 18 expresses the chain of command, whereby the Ruach, Spirit, which is the will of HaKodesh Baruch Hu, clothed in the Chaya, Rashi, caused the Chaya, that is the living creatures, to move or to act. And this in turn automatically caused the Ofan to move or act, since the spirit of Chaya was in the Ofan. Okay. Deep kind of stuff that we're getting there. Now the word ring appears twice in verse 18, and a cognate of it appears once. The Hebrew 1354 is gav, a two-letter root meaning hollow or curved, and possibly referencing the human back or rib cage, where the spine is the center and usually has the ribs kind of rising toward the back before curving to create the rib cage that protect our most vital organs, in the heart, lung, and that like that. From non-puncturing assault, okay? They're not going to stop. If somebody sticks a knife in you, they're not going to stop it. But they'll stop, something hitting you in the chest that's wider than the gap between the ribs. Where was it? In that little anthropomorphism, I try to make the description make sense in modern English. KJV rings, gavim, are like the ribs in the human rib cage that protect the vital organs of the wheels, the ofanim, which are the bodies that carry and act upon directions of the living creatures, the chayot, who are the spirits of those living creatures in direct communication with Yah. The word translated chai is goba, elation or arrogance is what it translates to, from the same three-letter root, with the idea of haughtiness or pride, which may be why they were dreadful. Dreadful, as the Hebrew 3374, is feminine, from the Hebrew 7372, yare, to fear, call to attention or constant attention, almost as if once you get a glimpse, you keep your attention on it, periodically looking over your shoulder so it can't get you from behind. Verse 19, the chayot, the living creatures, are the center of the action, slow as it may seem, because they are Yah's agent in this world. When the chayot move, everything around them moves, including the rings, the gavim, associated with the wheels, the ofanim. And all of us have this same kind of stuff happening within us all the time, every second of every day. And we all are pretty much unaware of it. And I think that grieves Yah's heart. We can all be a part of this action, but Yah won't force us to be in on it. He wants us to allow work through us for His glory. And He didn't give us this book, and especially this chapter, to gloss over it because it's too deep for us, because it really isn't. We have begun to scratch the surface, been given a place to start. Maybe we each should try to figure out what the gavim are in our ofanim existence. Okay? We are the ofanim, is basically what I'm thinking about. Ruach, in verse 20, goes wherever he wants to go, and he carries us with him. It's up to us about what he wants from us. And I think that if we were to ask him to show us, he would respond as quickly as he is able, like immediately. The only thing that's keeping him back is ourselves. In verse 20, Ruach HaKodesh wants us to go where he goes. Our spirit should go with him willingly. If I'm getting this chapter correctly, Yah is carrying us as dead weight, constantly prodding us with truth, till we decide that we want to follow him willingly, which is when he lets us follow on our own. When we stumble, he picks us, carries us for a while, until we're ready to follow again, and etc. The chayot are to follow Ruach and then lead the ofanim, which direct the gavim according to the will of the Ruach. That's what I got through.
Okay. Ken, you want to add anything?
5 minutes.
You want to add before?
Let's see. I commented up to verse 21, so I don't know if we read past that, did we?
No, we read. That's where we stopped.
Okay. then I guess we need to read on a little bit.
Okay, where these went, this is the verse I read. When these went, they went. And when they stood, they stood. And when they were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up together. Again, I picture a landing gear, or at least something that is clearly attached. For the spirit of the living creatures, the Ruach, was in the wheels. So that part is interesting. And, you know, as a metaphor, I've mentioned this already. If you understand the idea of cycles within cycles, wheels within wheels, and the cyclical nature of human history, it makes a lot of sense to me that the spirit of the life here is in these cycles, these turning things, these wheels. All right, 22 says, the likeness of the firmament above the heads of the living creatures was like the color of an awesome crystal stretched out over their heads. And under the firmament, their wings spread out straight, one toward another. Each one had two which covered one side, and each one had two which covered the other side of the body. When they went, I heard the noise of their wings like the noise of many waters, like the voice of the Almighty, a tumult like the noise of an army. And when they stood still, they let down their wings. And let's go one more verse. We'll read 25 where it says, a voice, coal, came from above the firmament over their heads. Whenever they stood, they let down their wings. And let's pause before we talk about the throne. We'll pick it up at 26 next time. Ken, we'll go to you.
Verse 22. Now, since this is a vision, I can only imagine that the idea of a beautiful crystal is a picture of not only the beauty of our skies above, but also of all of the heavens. I recall the beauty of the city of Jerusalem, or Jerusalem, coming down from the heavens in the book of Revelation, and how its beauty was also described with gems. So, and here, keep in mind that this is, it says that the firmament is upon the heads, but that can also be the word over, meaning on top of or over their heads. I believe this is to show separation between these creatures and what is above the firmament, which we're about to read on and find out. So, but there is again that separation, just like in the beginning, in Bereshit or Genesis chapter 1, there were firmaments created, okay, and this separated things. This definitely was one of the main separations, was between the heavens and the earth. That was one of the firmaments anyway. And then, of course, you had the firmament beneath as well. So this is speaking of, in verse 22, the firmament that is between these entities and whatever is above it. So this is over their heads, not really upon their heads. I don't think it's supposed to mean that it's sitting on top of their head, like a woman carrying a vase above their head, which I used to watch that a lot in India or down in Africa. Women like to help with the men doing the work, and they would literally carry heavy things like mortar and brick upon their heads, you know. But I don't think this is like that. This is just simply saying it's above them, you know. Verses 23 and 24. Now, verse 23 is repeating, or at least backing up, what was said back in verse 11, in that the wings were joined together and covered their bodies. But it's then further explained about flight, in that there is a great noise, which Yah seems to utilize often throughout Scripture to increase the awe and the wonder of a thing, you know, when there's noise associated with something. And Ezekiel is likening the noise of their wings.
Okay, we have the noise of a commercial coming up. So we'll pause and pick it up there. Last segment after this.
Soon, cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know something. I'll be no more, and I
Do-do-do-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Keeping Torah's a joy to do. They said the 613 and many more. Don't they know what's really true? It's you and I, will be and you. I keep the peace. Shabbos too. 6,000 years old, it's not new.
All right, we are back, folks. Last segment for today. I actually have hope that we're going to make ourselves all the way through Ezekiel chapter 1, but we still got several verses to go, and we're getting to some of the parts that are beginning to summarize some things now. When we hit the bottom of the hour break, I think we interrupted Ken, having to do with this voice coming down from the firmament, and let him pick it up where he wants.
Yeah, let me just maybe reiterate a few words here. I just want to make sure I get the whole message out. So regarding verses 23 and 24, so verse 23 seems to be repeating or at least backing up what was said back in verse 11 in that the wings were joined together and covered their bodies. But it's then further explained about flight in that there is a great noise which Yah seems to utilize to increase the awe and wonder of a thing. And Ezekiel is likening the noise of their wings to both great waters and the voice of our Almighty. Now this, I cannot quite imagine with this puny brain of mine. But likening this noise to great waters and his own voice, it is truly giving this voice or this sound of the wings that are the work is really a picture, I think, of the movement or the where these creatures are going, meaning going straight in the ways of Yah. that's the real beauty of it. That noise is so great, and it should be, because we know the expectation here. We know the outcome. Because of the fact that they are moving straight, okay? The outcome is what the Almighty wants. And thus, it should be a awesome and wondrous noise, you know?
Okay, let me just make
that
one correction if I make
great words in his voice.
Because when an engineer uses the term noise, there's an implication that there's no information contained. In other words, noise by definition is random, whereas this is a voice, and actually, in my mind, anything but noise. It's about as far from noise as you can get. It's, in fact, his voice, and there's more information contained in there than we can probably wrap our heads around. So that's just my personal correction. It could be loud, but it's not a noise in that sense.
Right. That's actually the word noise is the word kol in the Hebrew, which
voice.
Kol is more often translated as the word voice.
Yes.
So, yes, noise and voice is one and the same. It's Strong's number H6963 again, which is the word kol. So anyway, yeah, that's what I had through verse 24. So I'll go ahead and let MP catch up.
All right. Well, I'll almost. Because I'm going to verse 23. Okay.
Okay.
In verses 21 to 23, which seem difficult to follow in the KJV English, Yah is telling us that when everything is working smoothly, the leaders lead and the followers follow in the hierarchy that he has established. The hierarchy is Yah himself, Ruach HaKodesh, the Chayot, the living creatures, the Ofanim, and the Gavim. Okay, there are five levels that we see in this chapter, and those are the guys. Now, in verse 22, there was a likeness of the expanse, which is above our heads, the heavens, above the heads of the Chayot, as the color of the terrible crystal that was stretched over all these creatures' heads. Need to try to unpack that. By the way, Yah does this kind of revelation so that we'll take the time to do this and get to know him better. Don't assume that I'm getting this right. Be Bereans and check me out. MC and Ken, if they haven't done so yet, will start picking this to pieces, I am sure. Anyway, here we go. So here goes nothing. The likeness of the firmament. Likeness is from the Hebrew 1823, demut, which is something like, well, something like. That's what it means. So something like the expanse of the heavens was upon their heads, plural, of the chaya, the living creatures. Okay, chaya is singular, okay, but it's upon the heads of the chaya, the living creature. May I speculate that this chaya is the risen Mashiach Yeshua? Too late, already dead. Now, the likeness of the firmament has the color of the terrible crystal. But wait, the word color is translated from the Hebrew 5869, ayin, eye. Okay? I think that this may be the source of the expression, this thing has eyeball, meaning what beauty. So the likeness of the firmament is the eye of the terrible crystal. Terrible probably isn't what we think it is. Okay, now, I haven't looked it up yet, but terrible is from the Hebrew 3372. I'm telling you, I'm writing this as I'm studying it, okay? So the likeness of firmament is the eye of the terrible crystal. Terrible probably isn't what we think it is. It is, I haven't looked it up yet. Oh, I'm sorry, wait a minute. I will assume that this is a positive passage and that this phrase is talking about concentrating on applying our being to our unity in Yah. If we fail at that, we are already defeated.
Which verse, MP?
The key to my last phrase is... I'm looking in verse 22.
Okay, 22 is where you see the word terrible 22. Translated in your rendering?
Yes. Let me see. The color of the terrible crystal is where I'm coming from.
Yeah, and I don't see that in my rendering at all, so that's why I wanted to find it in whatever you're looking at.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway, where was I? Here, the terrible is from the Hebrew 3372, Yara, or Yare.
Awesome.
To fear or to call constant attention. And crystal is from the Hebrew 7140, Karach. To cohere or to hold together. I will assume that this is a positive passage and that this phrase is talking about concentrating on applying our being to our unity in Yah. If we fail in that, we are already defeated. The key to my last phrase is unity in Yah, which lamestream Christianity and all the other Yah-fearers have failed miserably at. We're great about unity in our doctrine. But the problem with our doctrine is that it is ours, not necessarily Yah's. We need to put pet doctrines aside and unify in the Ruach of Yah. Now, in verse 23.
Before you move, Mark,
now,
if I can.
Go ahead.
If I can interrupt there, the New King James translates that word as awesome, but you're right. The root word is yare, and when you said that, I wanted to make sure I double checked it first, but that's the same word literally that is afraid or fearsome or to fear not. And it's used over and over and over again, and generally it's rendered as fear. But in this case, it's also used for a reference to Yah, and it is fearsome in the sense that he is awesome. So I think that's a I don't like the new I like the New King James better than the old King James of the rendering there of Yare into an awesome crystal, and that really does make more sense. Go ahead.
And I like this etymological dictionary, Biblical Hebrew, because that you actually get a Jewish influence into what you're thinking instead of the mainstream, lamestream church. Anyway, getting back to where I was at here. The key to my last phrase is unity in Yah, which lamestream Christianity and all the other Yah-fearers have failed miserably at. We're great about unity in our doctrine, but the problem is it's our doctrine. Okay, it's ours, not necessarily Yah's. We need to put pet doctrines aside and unify in the Ruach of Yah. Now, in verse 23. Now remember that the the firmament, the expanse, is stretched over the heads of the Chaya, the living creatures, in verse 22. And here, in verse 23, the wings of the Chayot are straight, yashar, which in this case probably means faithful to duty. And each Chaya, that is living creature, is faithful to his duty to his brother Chayot. Okay, every Chaya has two sets of wings, as we stated before. I think that after the colon in verse 23, the description is in how the Chayot covered each other while in formation. They seem to be covering each other's bodies with their wings so that an attacker, who would be incredibly stupid to attack this group, perhaps covering their neighbor's front to their right and to their neighbor's backs on their left. I assume that the Chayot's wings were impregnable. Okay, so these guys are, you've got four living creatures. They're moving in a formation that looks like a cube, and they're covering each other from all the different angles. That's the way that that looks to me. And that's really the way that we all ought to be when we're talking, when we're hanging out with each other. We ought to be covering each other's tails. Okay? That's what I got through verse 23.
Okay, Ken?
No, I think I finished through 24.
Okay, well then we're ready to roll. I'm going to read through the rest.
That's all right. I'm going to cover that in a few minutes. Go ahead.
We'll read through the rest of the chapter, and then we'll talk about some of the summaries. We've got about 15 minutes, and what I want to do is I want to move towards at least a bit of a summary today before we break for a week. So above the firmament over their heads was the likeness of a throne, in appearance like a sapphire stone. On the likeness of the throne was, notice he keeps using the word likeness here, was the likeness with the appearance of a man high above it. So he's not saying it is a man, he said it looks kind of like that. Also from the appearance of his waist and upward, as it were, I saw the color of amber with the appearance of fire all around within it. And from the appearance of his waist and downward, so lower part of his body, as I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire with a brightness all around. So he's lots of fire here, but there's a difference between the part above and the part below. Like the appearance of a rainbow on a cloud on a rainy day. Now, that's a great metaphor. A rainbow on a cloud on a rainy day. So was the appearance of the brightness all around it. So lit literally through a prism, kind of a diffusion is the way I would read that. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of Yahuwah. And with that, let's go to Ken and let him comment, and then we'll go back to MP.
Okay, I'm going to just comment on the last, four verses, 25 through 28. We again see that from above being described with the beauty of gemstones to include what appears to be above the firmament, which is a throne. It's interesting that there is only one entity being described here at the throne. Not quite what I would have expected. I might have expected our Messiah standing at the right hand of our Father. But here we have the appearance of a man and no other. Thus, I can only imagine that this would be describing our Messiah and no other. We should note that no other is worthy to be sitting at a throne as king other than Yah himself or our Messiah. But since a great spirit is not depicted, and instead there is the appearance of a man, I can only gather a single remaining option in that this is our Mashiach. And his surroundings does match that of various Brit Hadashah or New Testament scriptures, to include the idea mentioned in the Gospel accounts of our Messiah returning as he left from within the clouds. And of course, this fiery description matches that of Yochanan's or John's vision in Revelation chapter 1. Thus, for me, this appearance of a man can only match that of our Messiah. So that's what I have through the end of the chapter. And I'm going to pass it over to MP, but I just want y'all to know that before we move on, I have a synopsis I'd like to share after we're through with the verses. Okay?
Okay?
Okay, go ahead, okay. Mark.
So, in verse 24, Yehezkel, our eyewitness to this entire episode, this is the fourth time he's referred to himself. There will be two more. This establishes his bona fides, by the way. Okay, in verse 24, Yehezkel describes what he saw and heard when they all started flying at once. Have you ever seen a movie or documentary on the tube or in a theater when the filmmaker recorded a herd of birds trying to take to the air at once? Okay? It's loud. It's really loud. Imagine all the angels of heaven and earth taking flight at once. I think that's what Yehezkel describes here. He says, like many waters. Have you ever been to Niagara Falls? It's loud, man. It is really loud. I can imagine a really large waterfall. I don't think Niagara comes close to the sound of what all the chayot of Yah lifting off at once, okay? I don't think it comes even close. In verse 24, all they did was go to parade rest, and Yehezkel has a hard time describing it. I probably would have said, hey, how about a little warning next time, huh? A warning probably wouldn't help. It would still be so loud. Anyway, in verse 25, Yehezkel heard a voice from the heavens, which drew his attention to witness verses 26 to 28. He saw something like a throne that appeared to be sapphire blue in color, and on it sat what appeared to be a man. The description above the firmament tells me that the throne is above the atmosphere. Treasury of Scripture Knowledge has a comment. It goes like this, and above. Archbishop Newcomb judiciously observes, we need not allegorize the circumstances of this august vision too minutely. Many of them augment the splendor of the scene, while others, no doubt, have much significance, which should be pointed out rather by a correct judgment than a luxuriant imagination. Okay, Archbishop Newcomb. Must have been a ton of fun at a party, huh? There is no way that anyone could get anything like a grasp on the depth of this chapter without an imagination and a healthy respect for the language of the Scripture. Church doctrine needs to be set aside, and a good concordance and Hebrew dictionary, along with an imagination, needs to be deployed. The descriptions require an imagination to understand. Do they not? I mean, think about it, what we've just read through here today. You have got to have an imagination to put this all together. Case in point, verse 26, KJV, twice uses the phrase, as the appearance. Two of the most important words in biblical interpretation are like and as. In fact, they're the most, I think. Like is describing something similar to something that's known. As is describing something that isn't just similar, but identical. As is also one of my favorite Stevie Wonder songs from 1976. Don't get me started on that or I'll sing it. Anyway, there is not a throne, but a likeness of a throne. As the appearance of a sapphire means that it is a deep blue color, like a clear sky sunset just before the sky goes dark. Okay? I mean just before. It's like the great blue flash. You know what I mean? MC can probably attest to that since he lives at around 9,000 feet of elevation in southern Colorado. And on that throne was one with a likeness as the appearance of a man above upon it. Now, I could be wrong, but I think that that is Yeshua himself, complete with the nail, spear, and thorn scars. And he is not on the throne, but above it. That it is Yah is just about certain. That he looks like a man means he is Yeshua, to my mind, anyway. Now, here's a Zamra on verse 26. And above the firmament, there was over their heads, was a likeness of a throne. And upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness of the appearance of Adam. In verse 26, riding the chariot is Adam, the Holy One, blessed be He. The gematria of the milui expansion of the letters of the Tetragrammaton are aleph, expressing the absolute unity of God on all levels, is 45. And by the way, that's aleph, dalet, mem. Add them together, you get 45. Adam. The prophet says, saw only a likeness like the appearance. It is forbidden to confuse the mashal, the metaphor, with the nimshal, the subject of the comparison, and to imagine for a moment that the prophet saw a human form. The human form as we know it is but the faintest reflection of a reflection of the divine reality. Yes, that's correct. It said that just like that. The human form as we know it is but the faintest reflection of the divine reality of which Ezekiel caught a glimpse. Okay? And he's described this the best he possibly could, but he only got a glimpse of it. Now, verse 27 is also has some interesting uses of as. Amber is a yellow-brown colored gemstone, like the emerald that we talked about before. Here's a Zamra on verse 27. And I saw something like the color of electrum. That is the word there is chashmal in the Hebrew in verse 27. Rashi comments, we are not permitted to seek to understand the meaning of this verse. That is Chagigah 13a. That's Rashi's writing. There was a certain boy who wanted to understand the meaning of the Chashmal, and a fire came forth and consumed him, because he had not reached the proper age. But let Hananiah, son of Chizkiah, be remembered for good, because if not for him, the sages would have taken the book of Ezekiel out of the biblical canon on account of the passages that apparently contradict Torah. What did he do? They brought him 300 barrels of oil to light his lamp, and he sat in an attic and darshaned Ezekiel to solve the contradictions. That's according to Haggagah, and that's an ibid for there. Now, verse 28 from Azamra says this, as the appearance of a rainbow, verse 28, contrary to the philosophy of the rainbow generation, the Talmud teaches that it is improper to gaze for long upon the rainbow, though glancing momentarily is permitted, since it alludes to the glory of Elohim. Whoever sees the rainbow in the cloud ought to fall upon his face, as it says, like the appearance of the rainbow, and I fell on my face, in Berachot 59a. And that, brothers, is what I've got here, and we're just about at the end. We got about a minute left.
Go to Ken, let him do a bit of summary. So, Ken, in 1 minute, summarize all this for us as we go to break.
Oh, I can't get through my last synopsis here in 1 minute, so
I didn't expect you to, but give it a shot.
Go ahead.
Give it what you got. We're going to be out of time anyway.
Okay, well, this concludes the descriptions given in Ezekiel's vision given to him, which is detailed here in chapter 1. Now, I'm sure the big question for us all is, what does this vision depict? Now, I believe the time frame may be revealed in this vision in that there is a firmament between the throne and these living creatures. Thus, this is most assuredly not eternity, considering such separation was needed. I believe Yah will not further separate us from himself with a firmament, but will be together as it was in the Garden of Eden. And since these living creatures seem to be driven or guided by their wheels, which were controlled by or representative of their spirit, then I would also conclude that these four entities symbolized mankind. Though all living creatures have breath, all but man seem to be guided instinctively without spirit.
All right. Well, hopefully we'll just pick it up there next week. We'll summarize Ezekiel 1 as we begin. Hey, thanks, guys.
Come on, folks.